today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Monday, April 8th. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker, and here is our first story. Iowa women's basketball, a new era. Win or lose, Caitlin Clark and company have pushed the sport to new heights. This is out of Iowa City. Win or lose, it was a foregone conclusion before the game even began Sunday. The magic happening in NCAA women's basketball this year, thanks to Caitlin Clark and the Hawkeyes, has launched women's basketball into a new stratosphere, with a new legacy solidified after a second eye-catching season. The star point guard didn't just shatter a new ceiling for women, she incited a new generation of fans to demand a larger building. As Clark shot her last shots on the court before going pro, the Hawkeyes weren't just aiming for a historic win, they were setting the stage for fans. They'll stick around to support women's basketball thanks to what they've seen this year. That's a momentum not even the undefeated South Carolina Gamecocks can stop. When Moscow grandmother Kim Nelson attended Friday's watch party at Carver Hawkeye Arena, the Hawkeye win and wild finish against UConn was an emotional moment. Grandma's crying, her 8-year-old grandson, Maverick, texted to his mother at its conclusion. But how could you not be emotional about it? It's experiencing history, said Nelson, 50. I'll remember this for the rest of my life. Win or lose, she vowed to cry again at the end of Sunday's championship, Iowa's second in a row, because of the representation the team has given Iowa. And she promised Maverick that, while he isn't crying now, that it's something he'll recount to his children someday, too. Nelson has been a fan for the last 4 years, but more seriously in the last two. The Hawkeyes' competitiveness and ability to outshine other teams this year made her a more serious fan, even before Clark started breaking serious records. They're representing everyone in Iowa, Nelson said. While she and her husband have been season ticket holders for other sports in the past, this year's plays under head coach Lisa Bluter have made them women's basketball fans for life. For them, the new injection of respect for the sport has astronomical meaning. For ages, she said Hawkeye football has been the focus of Iowa sports. In March Madness in most years, it's mostly been about the men's teams. But for fans raising boys like her family, their next season tickets will be for women's basketball. It's about lifting people up. It doesn't matter what gender, color, race, any of that, she said. For this to happen 2 years in a row, it gives me chills whether they win or lose. Val Bonnet, a Hawkeye grad and retired doctor from Pella, said Clark's legacy is inseparable from the strides the team has made as they set records in viewership, sell out home games, and even away games at other arenas. As each player appeared before the tip-off, one by one, the crowd dotted with Clark's 22 jerseys roared almost equally for most of the players, a telltale sign that the momentum filling every section allotted for the watch party was bigger than any one player. But with a multitude of eye-popping numbers to point to, one thing that stands out to Bonnet is the new culture this team has embraced. Under Bluter's leadership, she said Clark's departure to the WNBA draft doesn't spell the end for Iowa's newfound recognition. In every single interview, all of these girls say how much they care about their teammates. There's no I in team for Iowa, she said. I think that Lisa and the other coaches are setting a foundation that they're going to see success with for a long time. Nearby, another spectator with her two children concurred. It seems like they're more of a family than a team, said Katie Rourke of Iowa City. I think Clark has started something. Thanks to Clark, the arrival of a new era for college women's basketball is not even a question for Bonnet. Caitlin could be the face of that. Not only is she ridiculously talented, but she has a presence, Bonnet said. You want your kids to follow in her footsteps. There are other people that play basketball that you don't want your kids to behave like. She hopes others, with the right amount of capital, will capitalize on the velocity that Clark has generated by creating a new professional team somewhere in Iowa. As the first quarter got well underway, former Iowa Spirit squad members Oz Agbezi and Nate Volk talked about the new energy they sensed in women's basketball. In Agbezi's junior year of college, roughly a decade ago, the black curtains partitioning off much of the arena were installed to funnel fans down for the women's basketball games. The curtains were only pulled up for men's wrestling and men's basketball when larger crowds inundated the stands. Over the last 2 years, they watched for the first time in their lives as the curtains came down for women's basketball, as the Hawkeyes sold out home games and even arenas at away games. Seeing that is so incredible, because I remember when we couldn't get over 9,000 fans. Now you're talking about 56,000 people coming to watch an exhibition game. With the stars aligning on pent-up excitement, once-in-a-generation players, better social media treatment, and better marketing, he said it will absolutely translate to better parity for the WNBA as Clark goes pro. The future of women's basketball, as stars like Clark exit, will be up to the marketing strategy of the WNBA and NCAA, Agbeze believes, as they decide whether to double down on the Juju Watkinses, Hannah Hidalgos, and Hannah Stolkes left in the sport. A few rows away, parents Nate and Emily Burkholt held their young daughters on their laps as the second quarter unfolded at the peak of Iowa's temporary lead. Nate, with seven-month-old Annie, directed his daughter's attention to important points in the game as he explained something she wouldn't understand today. Though Clark brought them out as new fans in a relatively new community for the Iowa City residents, what's more is the community Clark has brought out among a perhaps unlikely conglomerate. It's wonderful to give them the opportunity to see where they can go, and there's no limit to the opportunities they have ahead of them, Emily said. Seeing the community embrace that and really stand strong behind women is awesome. All the things they're doing to bridge the gap between men's and women's is pretty cool to see, Nate concurred. Hopefully, this moment continues. Our next article, what to expect from solar eclipse. 83% of sun will be covered in Iowa today, but clouds might get in the way. This is by Emily Anderson. A total solar eclipse will make its way across parts of the United States today, and while Iowans won't see the totality of the eclipse without traveling, a significant chunk of the sun will be blocked by the moon at midday. With its path going just diagonally across the United States, everybody in the U.S., save Alaska, will see at least a partial eclipse, said Thomas Hockey, a professor of astronomy at the University of Northern Iowa. The partial eclipse will start to be visible in eastern Iowa at 12:46 p.m. It will reach maximum coverage at 2:01 p.m. and will end at 3:16 p.m. At its height, 83% of the sun will be covered. But even 27% of the sun still is enough for it to look like daytime outside, so the effect won't be too noticeable without observing the sun directly, Hockey said. A storm system is predicted to start moving through the Midwest on Sunday night into today. So there's a 50-50 chance the clouds will have cleared in time for the eclipse, according to the National Weather Service office in the Quad Cities. Hockey, who has seen 10 total solar eclipses and several partial eclipses, said traveling to see an eclipse in its totality is 10 times better, but that seeing a partial eclipse can be interesting too. It's such a familiar object, he said. We totally take it for granted, this circle of light in the sky that we call the sun. To have it change its shape, to start to resemble the old video game of Pac-Man, is a very unusual sight. Typically, the Earth experiences around 5 solar eclipses each year, but most of them aren't total eclipses, and even the ones that can be hard to get to, Hockey said. It's random, he said. It could be the Sahara Desert, could be the next time in Antarctica, and of course, quite often, it's in the middle of the ocean. The last solar eclipse seen in the United States was August 21, 2017. The next one visible in the contiguous United States will be 20 years from now in 2044, followed shortly by another in 2045. Alaska will see a total solar eclipse in 2033. Eclipses are predicted based on geometrical calculations and the positions of the Earth, the Moon, and the Sun in space. The rotation of the Earth causes an eclipse to travel for thousands of miles, though the width of the path is usually pretty small. It's maybe less than 100 kilometers wide, and if you are 101 kilometers away from the center line, you will not see a total solar eclipse, Hockey said. Anyone planning to watch the eclipse should use proper eclipse glasses or solar viewers, Hockey said. Any partial eclipse, even a pretty deep one like we'll be experiencing here, where most of the sun will be blacked out, you still have to use protective filter glasses, Otherwise, it is not safe for your eyes to look at the sun, Hawkey said. During the few minutes the sun is fully covered in a total eclipse, it is safe to look at the sun without glasses because most of the damaging rays of the sun are blocked by the moon, according to Hawkey. But for anyone watching from outside the total eclipse area, or watching before or after the total eclipse, protective eyewear is necessary. Regular sunglasses are not adequate protection. The American Astronomical Society has a list on its website of companies that produce safe solar viewers, and a number of Iowa retailers have suitable viewers for sale. Today's eclipse will be the 11th total solar eclipse Hawkey has witnessed. The first was in Hawaii in 1991, and he traveled to Turkey in 2006 and to Mongolia in 2008 to take in total eclipses. Traveling to see eclipses is a wonderful excuse to go to places that you might not otherwise have thought of visiting and finding some very interesting places and people around the world, Hawkey said. This year, he will be taking 11 students to Indiana to see the eclipse, the third time he's taken a class to view a solar eclipse. I'm at a point where I get just as much of a thrill out of sharing the experience with people who have not seen a total solar eclipse before, he said. Each time there is an eclipse within easy traveling distance, Hawkey, who teaches science and astronomy courses, teaches a one-semester liberal arts class focused on eclipses. The class covers astronomical information like how eclipses are predicted and what can be seen during an eclipse, as well as cultural information like how eclipses have been reflected in literature and art throughout history. The class includes a trip to view the eclipse. Students create a final project about the eclipse, factoring in a plan B if they are unable to view the eclipse due to weather. This is an opportunity to see an unusual feature of nature, and you don't need to really be guided or use special fancy equipment, Hawkey said. Yes, the eclipse glasses, but otherwise it's just you looking up at the sky, and you can't miss it. That kind of event that's so accessible like that appeals to me and hopefully will appeal to a whole lot of other people as well. This one, because of media attention and because the path goes over such a populated part of the United States, I suspect might be the most watched eclipse perhaps ever in history. One dead, one hurt, as Cedar Rapids officers respond to call. An armed man making threats was killed and a bystander who had called police for help was injured when three Cedar Rapids officers opened fire Saturday night in northeast Cedar Rapids after the armed man pointed a weapon at them, authorities said. None of the officers were injured. They were placed on leave, as is protocol, as the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation reviews the case. The incident unfolded just after 6:30 p.m. Saturday after a man, identified by the DCI as a suspect, asked for officers to respond to his house on 31st Street Northeast. Another man also called 911 and asked police to conduct a welfare check on the man who was acting erratically. It was reported the suspect was making homicidal and suicidal statements and was armed with a weapon, the DCI said in a news release. The officers found the suspect in the area and also the man who had requested the welfare check. Officers conducted a high-risk approach, and the suspect was observed with a weapon in his hands, the DCI release said. The officers gave verbal commands to the suspect to drop the weapon. The suspect raised the weapon in the direction of officers. Three officers discharged their weapons at the suspect, who immediately fell to the ground after being struck by gunfire. The man died at the scene, but the man who had called for help was also struck in the shooting and was taken to a hospital for treatment of multiple gunshot wounds. His condition was not released. The DCI did not release names of the man who died, the man who was injured, or the officers involved. The division said the results of its investigation will be turned over to the Linn County Attorney's Office for review and a determination on the use of force. This is the second DCI investigation of a Cedar Rapids police-involved shooting this year. On New Year's Day, Michael Griffin, 20, opened fire on Cedar Rapids police at least twice as he fled before he was forced off the road. Five officers fired at his car, believing he was still firing at them. The officers fired 63 rounds, but none of them struck Griffin. Investigators said he killed himself. Their actions on the morning of January 1, 2024, were taken to protect the community and to save their own lives, Linn County Attorney Nick Maybanks ruled after reviewing the investigation of that incident. Without question, this was clearly a justified shooting by these officers. Now I'm going to turn to the government notes section. E-scooters, bikes back in Cedar Rapids. Also, Marion seeks input on update to comprehensive plan. Electric bikes and scooters returned last week and are available for use on Cedar Rapids streets. Veo, the Chicago vendor that owns and operates Cedar Rapids' bike and scooter rental program, has worked with the city to improve the program in recent years with changes that promote safety and reduce the equipment left around the city. Since 2019, Veo has brought hundreds of bikes, stand-up scooters, and sit-down scooters to the city for people to unlock and ride using Veo Ride's mobile application. The fee depends on the devices. The e-bikes and scooters are available in downtown and the surrounding districts, including the Med Quarter, Nubo, Czech Village, and Kingston Village. All riders will be required to verify their ID to confirm they are 18 or older and complete a safety walkthrough this year. The Veo voice feature will remind users not to ride on sidewalks. Technicians from Veo will rebalance devices based on usage and after 48 hours of idling. Remove abandoned devices from sidewalks in areas beyond downtown. The city has added 6 new parking hubs for the devices in public rights-of-way, marked with reflective bollards and paint. According to a memo from City Manager Jeff Pomerantz to the Cedar Rapids City Council, data shows when participants store and retrieve devices in these street hubs, sidewalk riding is reduced. A new feature this year is Veo Plus, a monthly membership offering free unlock fees and unlimited rides. Veo Access, a discounted fare program, remains available as an affordable mobility option for those in local, state, or federal assistance programs. Marion asks, how should city grow? The City of Marion and consultant RDG Planning and Design are hosting a public open house to guide the city's effort to update its comprehensive plan, coined Marion 2045, a plan to reach new heights. The kickoff open house is planned for 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. April 18th at the Low Park Arts and Environment Center, 4500 North 10th Street. There will be no formal presentation, but attendees will be asked to think about future land use, identify growth and enhancement areas, and provide input on key areas such as housing, parks and recreation, and transportation. The comprehensive plan is a tool that gives community leaders and decision makers a roadmap for growth for the next 15 to 20 years. Those unable to attend may visit cityofmarion.org/compplan to take an online survey when it becomes available April 15th. People also can share comments on an interactive map and check for public participation opportunities. It's expected the plan will take 16 months to develop. Questions may be directed to the Planning Division of the Community Development Department at 319-743-6320. Marion offering tourism grants. Marion is taking grant applications from nonprofits for projects that increase tourism in the city. About $50,000 is available for grants funded by hotel-motel taxes collected in Marion. City staff, city council representatives, and council-appointed citizens will review applications, determine recommended funding awards, and make a recommendation to council for how to use the funds. Projects that boost tourism and result in more overnight hotel stays in Marion will get priority. Applications will be accepted online through the city website, www.cityofmarion.org/hotel-motel. Through May 6th. Award allocations are expected during the June 20th council meeting. Questions about the Hotel Motel Grant Program should be directed to Deputy Finance Director Brian McKenzie at 319-743-6353. League Legislative Forum, April 20th. Linn County residents may hear from state lawmakers about legislation passed by the Iowa legislature this session and ask questions in the final forum this season hosted by the Linn County League of Women Voters. The nonpartisan forum will be held from 10 to 11:30 a.m. April 20th in the Linn Dunn Building at the Linn County Fairgrounds in Central City. All Linn County legislators are invited to participate. Gilbert Street Bridge closing Friday in Iowa City. The Gilbert Street Bridge in Iowa City will be closing Friday, April 12th, as the city begins its months-long demolition and reconstruction. The $3.7 million project will bring a new four-lane bridge across Ralston Creek. The bridge will have 6-foot sidewalks on both sides. The project includes replacing water mains north of the bridge and burying overhead utility lines. Court Street remains closed at Gilbert Street, but is to reopen April 12th. City buses begin detours around the project Friday. Check the city website or transit app for details. Campgrounds set to open in Linn County. Campgrounds managed by Linn County Conservation will open for the season at 7 a.m. Friday and are typically open through mid-October. This includes campgrounds at Buffalo Creek, Morgan Creek, Pinnacon Ridge, and Wanatee Parks. Most sites are first come, first served. Only the new A-Loop at Buffalo Creek Park and A-Loop at Wanatee Park can be reserved online. More information, including rules and regulations, is available at linncountyiowa.gov/conservation. Ribbon cutting reset at Linmar facility. The ribbon cutting for the new tennis complex in the Linmar Community School District, delayed last week because of inclement weather, has been rescheduled to 4:30 p.m. Tuesday. The public is invited to join the ceremony at the new complex on the Oak Ridge Middle School campus, 4901 Alburnett Road in Marion. The complex includes spectator seating and more courts, replacing the 6 crumbling courts at the high school that had no room for bleachers. The project was part of the school district's 5-year facility plan. Marion Girls Soccer raising money. The Marion High School girls soccer team is doing something special this year to honor people who have been affected by breast cancer. The girls soccer team is raising money to donate to Especially for You at a Kick Cancer Night May 6th at a home soccer game against Williamsburg. The team is selling Kick Cancer apparel until April 15th. All gear will arrive by May 1st and will be distributed at the high school at 675 South 15th Street, Marion. All funds raised from the apparel and donations will be donated to Especially for You, a program that helps those who are unable to afford breast cancer screenings and other support services. Kick Cancer apparel can be purchased online at kickcancer2024.itemorder.com/shop/sale. Mount Vernon Schools hosting art show. The Mount Vernon Community School District has scheduled its first district art show in April, with an opening reception from 2 to 4 p.m. Saturday. The exhibition will be in the High School Performing Arts Center lobby at 731 Palisades Road Southwest in Mount Vernon during the weeks of the high school spring musical. The show will include 150 pieces of art created by students, kindergarten through 12th grade, curated by art teachers Bonnie Arnes, Samantha Jorgensen, and Sarah Lenhart. On the next page here in Iowa Today section, the headline is 80 years later, soldier laid to rest. And there are three pictures here. We have a picture of Jean Reckmeyer, niece of Private First Class Raymond U. Schlamp, receive his flag after a funeral service Saturday at Lawrence Community Center in Anamosa. The remains of Schlamp, who went missing in action in France during World War II, were identified thanks to DNA about 80 years after he went missing in 1944. Schlamp died at age 29 after being wounded in battle near Domont, France. He had served in General George Patton's Third Army since 1941. Then we have a picture of Reckmeyer posing for a portrait Saturday in Anamosa, and then a picture of the U.S. Marine Corps veteran Terry Happyman Wangler, watching the funeral service for Schlamp on Saturday in Anamosa. Now we're going to turn to the insight or opinion section, and I'll read the community letters. We have two today. The first one from William Copper in Marion, farmers unfairly blamed for rising cancer rates. The Gazette seems to unfairly point their fingers toward farmers for polluted waters and rising cancer rates in our state. We all drive to work, heat and cool our homes, turn on the lights, cook dinner on the stove, and plug in our electric cars. This contributes to fossil fuel burning and energy production despite advances in wind and solar. Industrial wastes are huge contributors of pollution, including forever chemicals in our soil and water. The high levels of naturally occurring radium, radon, and cobalt in the Midwest soils are a cause of concern. Let's take a look at every homeowner's lawn. Bluegrass is not blue or native to North America. It requires more land and water as lawn turf in the U.S. than do corn and wheat combined. We use 10 times more fertilizer and pesticide per acre on the over 40 million acres of our lawns than on corn and wheat. We can't eat it, only mow it. We water it from the faucet with treated drinking water, estimated to total 200 gallons of water per day per acre, costing us billions of dollars in a drought. Lastly, a recent study showed that a common ingredient in the milk of every breastfeeding mother across this nation was jet fuel residue. This unburned aviation fuel exhaust, vapor, rains down on every square inch of this planet. We all contribute and share the responsibility of our problem. And again, that was from William Copper in Marion. And our other letter is from Jim Walters of Iowa City. Dead bills can be resurrected with legislative tricks. The Gazette March 22nd editorial, Good Riddance to Bad Bills, worries that the problem with dead bills is they sometimes come back to life. Let's trace that back to 2012 and the matter of dove hunting, something the overwhelming majority of Iowans have always opposed. Through a bit of clever legislative legerdemain, abetted by Democratic Senator Dick Dearden, an avid dove hunter, and Senate Majority Leader Mike Gronstahl, a Democrat, but for what reasons, a bill was passed in the Senate after a closed-door Democratic caucus without any debate. Without a companion bill in the House, this is where it would have died. But lo and behold, the very next day, a dove bill was miraculously created and substituted for a bill dealing with an entirely different matter, youth raccoon hunting. Voila! The next morning, Governor Terry Branstad signed the bill authorizing dove hunting in a private ceremony in his office. 72 hours, start to finish. I warned then that this was the type of governance we could expect, and here we are with Kim Reynolds, someone who learned well at the feet of her master. That again was from Jim Walters of Iowa City. You are listening to the Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll go to today's obituaries. William Joseph Rockefeller, 70, of Iowa City, passed away at home on April 4th. A memorial gathering will take place from 3 to 5 p.m. Wednesday, April 10th, at the Kirkwood Room in Iowa City. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to the Eagles, FOE 695. Michael was born to Irving Delos and Rose Marie Boyle Rockefeller on March 19, 1954, in Mason City, one of 13 children born to the couple. After graduating from City High School in 1973, Michael served as a purchasing manager for Mercy Hospital for 40 years, retiring in 2013. Michael greatly enjoyed the outdoors. He was a hunter, a fisherman, and a sometimes golfer. Michael was good at cooking and invested a lot of time in his grandkids. He was a longtime member and contributor to the Fraternal Order of Eagles. Michael was a trustee of the local Eagles, FOE 695. Michael will be best remembered for his love of family and friends and willingness to help others. Michael is survived by his children, Michael Todd Rockefeller and Michaela Ruan, siblings Pat Rockefeller, Tom Rockefeller, Mona Eckerman, Paulette Jones, Kathleen Link, and Mary Rockefeller, sister-in-law Amy Rockefeller and Kim Rockefeller, brother-in-law Joe Zoll, and grandchildren Trevor James, Jasmine Rose, Emma Grace, Evan Paul, Colin Michael, Tara Anderson, and Lily Schrock. Michael is preceded in death by his parents, brothers Jack, Bill, Tim, and Todd, and sisters Suzette Zoll and Lynn Marie Apple. Kathleen Hernandez, Kathy, 93 of Iowa City, passed away on Wednesday, February 14th. Funeral Mass will be at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church in Hiawatha at 11 a.m. Saturday, April 20th. Visitation will be at the church starting at 10 a.m. A lunch reception will follow Mass at St. Elizabeth, and a burial at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery will conclude services. Billy Jean Lang, age 74 of Mount Vernon, passed away at his home on Saturday, April 6th. Bill was born October 11th, 1949, in Cedar Rapids, the son of Harry Victor and Wyona Walaska Ort Lang. He graduated from Mount Vernon High School in 1967. On October 12th, 1968, he was united in marriage to Connie Sue Forrest. Bill was a long-term owner and operator of Lang's service station in Mount Vernon. He enjoyed going to the casino, fishing, 60s country music, and having a cold Miller Lite. Bill was proud to donate to any cause and was a huge supporter of his community and the school district. He would do anything for anyone, and if he couldn't, he would find a way to get it done. Bill loved family get-togethers and especially following his grandchildren's events. Nothing made him more proud than watching his grandchildren doing what they love. Survivors include his three sons, Pat Lang of Mount Vernon, Jason of Marion, and Casey of Mount Vernon. Five grandchildren, Jacob, Stephanie, Wiley, Maley, and Tegan. Siblings, Beverly Chunka of Omaha, Nebraska, and Brenda Potter of Canton, Iowa. Brothers-in-law, Ronnie Forrest of Mount Vernon and Al Forrest of Cedar Rapids. Sisters-in-law, Linda Hunter of Hopkinton and Kayleen Forrest of Cedar Rapids, and many nieces and nephews. He was preceded in death by his parents, his wife of almost 50 years, Connie Lang, his sister, Bonnie Mealman, sister-in-law Bonnie Schaff, brothers-in-law John Chunka, and Fred Potter. A celebration of life will be held on Saturday, April 20th from 12 p.m. to 5 p.m. at Tin Roof Hideaway and Event Center, 1003 North Washington Street in Lisbon. In lieu of flowers, a memorial is being established. Zuko Redding of Cedar Rapids. On April 5th, Zuko Redding passed away peacefully at Oldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha. Zuko was born December 15th, 1943, to John and Effie LeBlanc in Mount Kisco, New York. She grew up in Texas, where she encountered Zen Buddhism as a university student. She obtained a Ph.D. from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 1977 and taught sociology in several states. Zuko embarked upon advanced training in Zen when she studied in Milwaukee with Tozen Akiyama and in Minneapolis with Denin Katagiri. In 1992, she was ordained in Japan by Sugan Narasaki. She remained to practice under his direction at Zuoji Monastery and its mountain training center, Shogoji. She was certified as a teacher in the Soto Zen tradition by Reverend Narasaki in 1996 and returned to the U.S. in 1997. Zuko established the Cedar Rapids Zen Center in 1999 and served as its resident teacher until her death. She was active in the Interreligious Council of Linn County for many years. According to her wishes, Zuko has been cremated with arrangements by Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Cedar Rapids. Information about her Hoji, 49th Day Memorial Service, will be shared on the Cedar Rapids Zen Center's website. Memorials may be directed to the Cedar Rapids Zen Center through their website. C. Jean, Jeannie Minahan Parr of Cedar Rapids passed away peacefully at the age of 72 on Saturday, April 6th. Services to include a visitation at All Saints Catholic Church, located at 720 29th Street Southeast, Cedar Rapids, on Thursday, April 11th, from 9 to 10 a.m. Following the visitation, there will be a Mass of Christian burial at All Saints Catholic Church on Thursday, April 11th at 10 a.m. Interment will be held at St. Joseph's Cemetery in Jefferson on Thursday, April 11th at 3 p.m. Jeannie was born on August 27th, 1951, the youngest daughter of six of Edward and Loretta Rowan Minahan near Jefferson. She graduated in May 1969 from Jefferson Community High School. She was married to Michael Clark from December 1970 to September 1990 and shared three children with him, Stephen, Laura, and Lee. She was later remarried to Dean Parr in June of 2005, who also has three children, Mick, Amanda, and James, each of whom were very close to Jeannie. Survivors include her husband Dean, her oldest son Stephen Clark, and daughter-in-law Claudia, her daughter Laura Clark, and her youngest son Lee Clark, and daughter-in-law Jean. Her grandchildren include Matthew, Jacob, Kenzie, and Waylon. Jeannie is also survived by three stepchildren, whom she had a close relationship with, Mick Parr, James and Allison Parr, and Alan and Amanda Vavra. Her step-grandchildren include Jackson, Ansley, Ava, Grace, and Alexandria. Jeannie is also survived by her sister, Mary Ellen, and brother-in-law Brian Carlson. Jeannie has numerous nieces, nephews, cousins, in-laws, and family friends she loved very much and held very dear to her heart. Jeannie was preceded in death by her parents, Edward and Loretta Minahan, her brothers Patrick, Dennis, Thomas, and her sister Sharon. They shared a family farm near Jefferson. She lived in several places during her lifetime, including Madison, Wisconsin, and Cedar Rapids. Jeannie had a special relationship with her grandchildren, whom she loved with all her heart. She shared many birthdays, holidays, and family reunions at her home in Cedar Rapids. Jeannie found the true love of her life when she met Dean during a class reunion in 2004, and they married during the Jefferson Bell Tower Festival in June of 2005 at the historic Minahan Schoolhouse. Jeannie supported the Lincoln Highway Association with Dean and many friends who shared awareness and its historical value that is special to the people of Iowa. She also loved to garden around her home each spring, planting flowers and new plants. Routinely, the front porch would be adorned with plants and flowers that included the occasional bird nest. In lieu of flowers, a donation can be made to the All Saints Catholic Church, the American Cancer Society, or the charity of your preference. Okay, I'm going to turn to the sports section, and we'll start with what's going on today in the area and what you can catch on TV and the radio. In high school track, we have Marion at Monticello Invitational. That's the boys' track at 4:30 p.m. And Regina at Wilton meet at 4:30 p.m. Girls' soccer, Washington at Prairie at 7 p.m. Iowa City West at Liberty at 5:15 p.m. And Regina at Bellevue at 5 p.m. Boys' soccer, Iowa City West at Liberty at 7 p.m. Regina at Bellevue at 6:30 p.m. We can also catch men's basketball tonight on television. We've got the NCAA championship, Purdue versus Connecticut, at 8 p.m. on TBS, TNT, or True TV. We also have Major League Baseball, White Sox at the Guardians at 5 p.m. on NBCS Chicago. Cubs are at the Padres at 8:30 p.m., and you can catch that on the Marquee channel. On the radio, you can also catch men's basketball, the NCAA championship, Purdue versus Connecticut, at 6:30 p.m. on KGYM. And Major League Baseball, the Cubs at the Padres at 8:30 p.m. on KXIC 800. And the headline, NCAA Women's Basketball Championship, South Carolina 87, Iowa 75. Bittersweet goodbye. And it shows a picture of Kaylin Clark looking up at the scoreboard near the end of the Hawkeyes' loss. We also have Megan Stolke and Gabby Marshall sitting next to her. Size, depth, the difference as glorious Hawkeye era ends with title game loss by Jeff Linder out of Cleveland. South Carolina was quite a bit bigger, a whole lot deeper, and a little bit better. The Gamecocks proved their number one ranking and completed a perfect season, pulling away late from number two Iowa, 87-75, in the NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament Final Sunday afternoon at Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse. South Carolina is so good, said Iowa's Caitlin Clark, who concluded a remarkable record-breaking career with 30 points, 8 rebounds, and 5 assists. There's only so much you can do. The Gamecocks, whose record was 38-0, captured their third national championship. They had won 2017, 2022, and now 2024, and won for the 80th time in their last 81 games. The lone defeat in that run was a 77-73 loss to Iowa in the 2023 national semifinals. Sunday, they were bigger, deeper, better, and hungry. I did want to see them in the national championship this year because what happened last year, South Carolina guard Raven Johnson said. It was an apology to my teammates, my coaches, and myself. There's no better way than to play them in the championship and beat them. South Carolina prevailed due to marked advantages in rebounds, 51 for them, 29 for us, second chance points, 30 for them, 16 for us, and bench points, 37 for them, 0 for us. They played 9 people in double figures for minutes. We had 6, Iowa coach Lisa Bluter said, just to have those extra fouls and extra legs. And not only their depth, their height. I'm not just talking about their centers. They're really pretty big at every position, which makes it hard. Hannah Stolke said, they O-boarded like crazy. Camilla Cardoso had 5 inches on me. Even if I box her out, she's going to get hers. The 6'7" Cardoso got hers for sure. 15 points and 17 rebounds. She's an amazing player, Iowa's Sydney Offalter said. Of course, it's hard to touch 6'7". And the Gamecocks got theirs. They are the 10th team in NCAA history to go undefeated. Iowa, whose record was 34-5, couldn't make a fast start stick and is the runner-up for the second straight year. The Hawkeyes fell to LSU 102-85 in the 2023 title game. The Hawkeyes scored the first 10 points of the game and led 20-9 at the midpoint of the opening quarter. We were well prepared, Iowa's Gabby Marshall said. Coach told us to play free and loose, and that's what we did. Clark had 18 points by the end of the first quarter, and Iowa led 27-20. From that point on, most of the big moments belonged to South Carolina. Cardoso's basket gave the Gamecocks their first lead, 36-34, with 4 minutes 56 seconds left in the second quarter, and they held a 49-46 advantage at the end of a highly entertaining first half. Iowa never led again. South Carolina limited the Hawkeyes to 5 of 17 shooting in the third quarter and pushed its advantage to 68-59 behind a pair of three-pointers by Tessa Johnson. The largest margin was 76-62 on Cardoso's putback with 7 minutes 45 seconds to go. Iowa got within 80-75 on a Falter's three-point play with 4 minutes 13 seconds left, but the Hawkeyes didn't score again. With someone like Caitlin, a 5-point lead versus Iowa is nothing, South Carolina coach Don Staley said. When there was a timeout called, you could hear all of the players, all of them, just talk about how we needed to have stops. 4 Gamecocks scored in double figures, led by Tessa Johnson's 19 points. Clark concludes her career with 3,951 points, most in NCAA history. Kate Martin added 16 points for the Hawkeyes, a Falter scored 12, and Stolke 11. And I'll read one more article here on Clark. Book closed on Clark's Iowa career, and what a great read it was for Iowa fans. This is also by Jeff Linder out of Cleveland. Thanks, Caitlin. That was the first theme the South Carolina coach Don Staley hit upon after her team topped Iowa for the NCAA Women's Basketball Championship. I don't want to not utilize this opportunity to thank Caitlin Clark for what she's done for women's basketball, Staley said. Her shoulders were heavy and getting a lot of eyeballs on our game. And sometimes as a young person, it can be a bit much, but I thought she handled it with class. I hope that every step of the ladder of success that she goes, she's able to elevate whatever room she's in. Clark scored 30 points, 18 in a frenetic first quarter, but South Carolina prevailed 87-75 Sunday afternoon at Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse. She finishes her career with 3,951 points, most in NCAA history, and 1,144 assists, third all-time. There's going to be tears, she said, holding it together admirably on the dais after the game. It is sad this is all over, and this is the last time I'm going to put on an Iowa jersey. It's the last time any Iowa women's basketball player wears 22, which soon will be shuttled to the Carver-Hawkeye Arena rafters. A statue of Clark, arms outspread, would be an appropriate final tribute somewhere down the line. She has raised the excitement of our sport, there's no doubt, Iowa coach Lisa Bluter said, just because she does things in a different way than anybody else can do. I really think that when she came in as a freshman and she said, "We're going to the Final Four," a lot of people laughed at her and maybe even laughed at her for coming to Iowa, quite honestly. Clark believed then, delivered. She led the Hawkeyes to a 109-30 record and three Big Ten tournament championships in her four unforgettable seasons and two NCAA championship games. It's no coincidence the interest in women's basketball, in attendance or television viewership, has never been higher. Iowa drew 9.9 million TV viewers for the title game with LSU last year, 12.3 million for the rematch with LSU in the Elite Eight last week, 14.2 million for the semifinal win over Connecticut on Friday. The figures for the championship game won't be released until today, but 15 to 20 million would be a good guess. Do I think South Carolina is a part of it? Yeah, we're a part of it, Staley said. I don't know what part, but you can see the numbers that when Caitlin plays in a game, you see the numbers. They're real numbers, and a lot of people like to deal in those real numbers. Her work here is done, well done. Next Monday, she'll belong to the Indiana Fever of the WNBA. I can't believe this is my last career game, Clark said. There's just so much to be proud of. And let's turn to Major League Baseball Roundup. Melendez lifts Royals to sweep. MJ Melendez hit a third home run of the series, a two-run drive, and a three-run seventh inning as the Kansas City Royals rallied to beat Chicago White Sox 5-3 on Sunday for a four-game sweep. The way these all four games transpired, they were all close in the middle to late part of the game, Kansas City manager Matt Quatraro said. To stick with it is really cool to see. Chicago started 1-for-9 for just the second time in the 124-year history of the franchise after going 0-for-10 in 1968. We had a lot of opportunities to score, White Sox manager Pedro Grifols-Aide said, and we didn't capitalize with the big hit. We should have brought that game home. Chicago ended a 19-inning scoreless streak in the fourth and led 3-0 in the fifth before Hunter Renfro's two-run homer off starter Garrett Crochet. Melendez hit a two-run homer in the sixth off Devi Garcia, who was 0-for-2, for a 4-3 lead, his third go-ahead hit of the series. Obviously a little bit of luck right there, Melendez said. I'm just thankful that I'm able to help do something to help the team win. It's just pretty crazy. Kansas City added a run when Kyle Isbell reached on what was scored on an infield hit when reliever Dominic Leon failed to catch the throw to first from second baseman Lennon Sosa. John Schreiber, who's 1-0, pitched a one-hit seventh, and James MacArthur got three outs for his second save as Kansas City completed its first four-game sweep since 2021. Cubs 8, Dodgers 1. Cody Bellinger homered against his former team and Shohei Imanaga threw four shutout innings in a rain-shortened start as Chicago won at home. Imanaga was lifted after the game resumed following a weather delay of nearly 3 hours. The left-hander allowed two singles, struck out three, and walked none, giving him 10 scoreless innings over his first two big league starts. The Cubs won for the sixth time in seven games. They took 2 of 3 in a weekend set that showcased four of the majors' top Japanese players. Shohei Ohtani doubled in Mookie Betts in the eighth to account for the Dodgers' only run. Ohtani also hit a two-out triple in the sixth, but Freddie Freeman bounced to third for the final out of the inning. Yency Almonte, 1-0, struck out two in a scoreless inning for the victory against his former team. Marlins 10, Cardinals 3. Miami ended its team record 9-game losing streak to start the season when Jazz Chisholm Jr. and Nick Gordon hit 3-run homers in a 6-run first inning. Miami had been the first team to start 0-9 since Atlanta and Minnesota in 2016. And Brewers 12, Mariners 4. William Contreras hit 2 home runs. Willie Adams also homered, and Milwaukee pounded Seattle. Contreras finished with 4 hits and 5 RBIs. Okay, I'm going to go back to the Iowa Today section. Artist asks judge to block demolition of Iowa art project. This is by Clark Kaufman. A New York artist is seeking a temporary injunction to block the planned demolition of a 30-year-old outdoor art installation in Des Moines. The installation at Greenwood Park, which consists of a pavilion and walkways surrounding a pond, was commissioned by the Des Moines Art Center in 1994 and was designed by New York artist Mary Miss. Greenwood Park is located just south of Grand Avenue and the Art Center. In 2023, the Art Center announced that, because the installation had fallen into disrepair, it posed a threat to public safety and would be demolished due to the high cost of repairs and ongoing maintenance. Since then, Greenwood Park neighbors and individuals within the art community have protested the decision. On Thursday, Miss filed a lawsuit against the Art Center in U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Iowa. In her lawsuit, Miss asserts that her 1994 contract with the center provides that the installation cannot be intentionally modified or damaged by the Art Center without her express approval. The lawsuit argues that while the city is contractually obligated to protect the installation from the ravages of time and weather, those same two threats to the project are now being used to justify the demolition in violation of the Visual Arts Rights Act of 1990. That law, which is part of the federal copyright law, provides artists with certain rights in preventing the destruction of works of recognized stature, even when ownership of the works has been transferred to others. The project is an original work of art and cannot be found anywhere else on planet Earth, the lawsuit states. Its destruction is its extinction. In addition to the injunction, the lawsuit also seeks to recover damages of up to $150,000 for the planned intentional destruction of Miss's work. It also seeks unspecified damages for breach of contract. The Arts Center has yet to file a response to the lawsuit. A court hearing on the temporary injunction is scheduled for 10 a.m. today. The center has said it plans to begin work this week on enclosing the pond and one section of the surrounding trail with fencing, after which the city will drain the pond and redirect the water to the Raccoon River. As part of the planned project, the boulders, walkways, enclosures, and bridges will be disassembled and removed over a period of 3 months. Okay, and our last article today is a Curious Iowa article. Did the circus inspire creation of Cedar Rapids Electric Company? Circuses brought electric lights to masses. This is by Bailey Saccone out of Cedar Rapids. Last month, a community member brought a few 1940s editions of the Gazette to our office. This included parts of the August 11, 1946 Iowa Centennial Edition that looked back on Iowa history and local firsts. In it, one headline caught our eye: First Electric Lights Brought Here by Circus. In the story, C.G. Green, the first president of the Cedar Rapids Electric Light and Power Company, said that in early June 1882, Barnum and Bailey Circus brought electric lights to Cedar Rapids. The story was parroted by an ad from the company in a different section of the newspaper, which read, "And instead of the bareback rider with the jewel-studded belt, it was electricity that Mom and Dad talked about during the long buggy ride home." Interest grew, and just 2 months later, on August 31, 1882, the Cedar Rapids Electric Light and Power Company was incorporated. It's a great story, but there's one problem. Barnum and Bailey's 1882 Circus Route book didn't record any shows in Iowa that year. In this installment of Curious Iowa, a Gazette series that answers questions about our state, its people, and our culture, we look at the advent of electric lights and how circuses brought the technology to the masses. We also dive into the early history of Iowa's electric utilities and where local lore got things wrong. Chris Berry, a circus historian and vice president of the Circus Historical Society, said many people saw electric lighting for the first time in James E. Cooper and James A. Bailey's shows. In 1879, Cooper and Bailey's Great London Circus was the first show to use electric lights. A few years later, Bailey would become partners with P.T. Barnum. A 1988 article in Bandwagon Circus magazine notes that circuses were early adopters of new technology. Owners of large circuses were always among the first to take advantage of technological progress, writes Orrin C. King. Prior to Cooper and Bailey, only a very small number of Americans had ever seen anything brighter than a kerosene lamp or a softly glowing gas jet. The electric light in 1879 was a miracle to the masses, and the show's press department made the most of it. Before the advent of electric lights, efforts were made to light shows using oil lamps or rush lights, which are long candles fueled by grease. King in Bandwagon wrote, 1,600 rushes, weighing about 1 pound and saturated with 6 pounds of tallow, would make a torch that would burn for about an hour, but in the process much heat was released and copious smoke produced. Council Bluffs was the location of one of the earliest known circus tent fires. Electric lights, on the other hand, required the use of a steam engine or gas generator. The systems needed to power lights were built onto a wagon. King wrote that when the Great London Circus came to Topeka, Kansas in 1879, a description of steam engine power generation was published in every newspaper in town. A 35-horsepower engine powered all the electricity. One light is equal to 3,000 candle power, or nearly 200 gas lights, and is cheaper by 75% than gas or oil. It is likely that many Cedar Rapidians experienced electric lights for the first time at a circus, but it likely wasn't in 1882 or through Barnum and Bailey's circus. To verify which circus could have brought electric lights to Cedar Rapids for the first time, and when, we spoke with historians at the History Center in Cedar Rapids, Illinois State University's Milner Library, and the Barnum Museum. We also searched through a circus route database and circus route book archive and newspaper archives. A further dive into Cooper and Bailey's whereabouts in 1879 provided another theory. On September 17, 1879, Cooper and Bailey's show came to Cedar Rapids. That was the same year Great London Circus started using electric lights. On April 7th, an article from the Philadelphia Inquirer detailed that Cooper and Bailey's show used electricity. Over the years, Cedar Rapids Electric Light and Power would grow and transform. In 1917, it built and operated the first automatic hydroelectric plant in the world. The hydroelectric plant's capacity in 1917 was 20,000 kilowatts. In 1932, the company changed its name to Iowa Electric Light and Power Company. In 1968, the company authorized the construction of the Duane Arnold Nuclear Plant in Palo. In 1994, the company changed its name again to IES Utilities. And finally, in the 1990s, Alliant Energy merged Cedar Rapids IES Utilities and Dubuque's Interstate Power Company into Interstate Power and Light Company. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. I'm your reader, Teresa Whitaker. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.